To answer is human, to question is divine. Welcome to the world of the Hidden Gateway, an exhilarating podcast exploring the concepts humans have been struggling with since the dawn of existence, such as, who are we? Is there such a thing as good and evil, or are they arbitrary constructs? Does the paranormal exist? How can we evolve to a higher state? Can our mind influence what we term as reality? Providing a transcendental approach combined with hard-nosed humanistic analysis, we invite you on a journey to question your worldview in this theater of life. Join our host, Justin Williams, as he explores the outer realms of faith, the supernatural, human potential, and even our concepts of the universal creator with a fascinating array of guests. This is the unseen world, magical, mysterious, and mystical, where your only limitation is your imagination. This is the Hidden Gateway.
Welcome back to another episode of the Hidden Gateway podcast. As always, I am your host, Justin Williams. Today's guest is Dr. Kenneth Carpenter. Dr. Carpenter is a licensed clinical psychologist and research scientist with over 20 years of experience developing, implementing, and evaluating evidence-based motivational and cognitive behavioral strategies for helping individuals make important lifestyle changes. He is the director of training for CMC Foundation for Change, a not-for-profit organization with the mission of improving the dissemination of evidence-based ideas and strategies to professionals and loved ones of persons struggling with substance use through the Invitation to Change approach. Today, we will be discussing his latest book, The Beyond Addiction Workbook for Family and Friends, Evidence-Based Skills to Help a Loved One Make Positive Change. Dr. Carpenter, welcome to the Hidden Gateway podcast. How are you doing?
Oh, Justin, thank you so much for having me, and I appreciate the kind words and just the opportunity to spend time with you and talk about what gives us meaning together. So thanks.
I like that, man. I like that, what gives us meaning together. And that's actually what I consider a very profound statement. You know, when you say what gives us meaning together, you know, not just you and I, but and not just the listeners of the Hidden Gateway podcast, but humanity as whole, right? Because when we talk about your book, The Beyond Addiction Workbook for Family and Friends, I think many people can resonate with this book because we all have been impacted, right, by our loved ones that have substance or alcohol or addiction issues, right, whether directly or indirectly. And as I mentioned earlier to you before we got going here, It's a great book, man. It really is. It's phenomenal. And from what I've read, it's not only a book that was written to help loved ones, but there's also some help in there for self as well along that journey. Am I correct?
Yeah, I think spot on with that. And that's, you know, as we were talking and just the idea of the human condition and humanness and being together, I think you're like pulling right from that bucket, which is when we really get down to thinking about living and the challenges of living in the human condition, we can find wisdom that transcends particular circumstances and can be useful kind of no matter what journey you're on, you know, and there's, so to your point, yeah, I think it's for self as well. There are some useful things there.
Very good, very good. Now, I know for me personally, I had a family member, a very close family member of mine who struggled with some substance abuse for probably 20 years or so. Thank God he's been in recovery now for probably for about 20 years and has made a complete change in his life, and he's doing very, very well for himself these days, thank God. But on the other hand, I also have another family member who I'm very close with who has battled alcoholism for years, literally since I would say the age of 18, 19 years old, right? And It's been this cumulative effect of different things that happened in his life, which I believe led to him taking that deep dive, that deep dark dive into alcoholism. And I, throughout the years, I try my best to help him and speak love and light into his life. But and I think to a certain degree, it's been helpful. But for whatever reason, he still cannot, I don't want to say kick the habit, but he still can't find that light. I like how that sounds a lot better. And for me, earlier on, and I would imagine a lot of people go through this, where they want to judge that individual and say, you should be doing this. Why are you doing that? So my question for you, Dr. Carpenter, what is the best way for someone to approach a problem without that judgment factor involved?
Yeah, it's challenging, such an important point. And you know, some of the things, at least in our work, working with families, working with people out in communities, about what some of the challenges are in trying to be helpful, trying to be present for people that may be struggling or seeing things from a different angle than they would be. You know, how do you step in a way that can be supportive and open doors, in a sense, for different possibilities to happen? And that critical first step is, like you're saying, what's the lenses you use to try to understand the actions of others that are around you? And the labeling can often come in as saying, you know, the judgment and the labeling says, here's the answer. This is why this person is the way they are. It's at least helping inform that. And what we've come to kind of try to work with people is this first step, which in a sense is, you know, behaviors make sense. And that's kind of our first message, that there's different ways we can think about it. There's different research or different vocabularies for it. But at its core, it's this idea, just as human beings, when we're invested in behaviors, it usually means because we're getting something out of it. It's serving a purpose. It's serving a function. And it may not be the best way to serve that purpose or the best way in all the circumstances to meet a need. But if we can approach and try to understand what's behind, you know, what's the person's why behind this behavior, sometimes that just helps take some of the sting and judgment out of it, creates a little bit more room to try to understand why a person would engage in this, and brings loved ones and family members closer. If they can get an understanding, or at least the why, it opens room for collaboration and other ways of going. And it's interesting when you say that, sometimes in our discussions with family members across the country, because of the judgment, because of just the tug of war that loved ones go through, some conversations that used to never happen, and again, I'm not saying it's a magic bullet, but conversations of someone trying to step back from the judgment for a moment, and when they can find that space to say, I want to understand what it's like for you. So what do you get out of it? What's worth all the investment you put into it? What's it like? And people come back and say, you know, it's the first time I've asked that question, and my loved one has been, no one's ever asked me that.
Wow.
So to your point, yeah, judgment's a human thing. We can label it. But that first idea of, well, how can you get a set of lenses that might open some doors and some possibility and bring a different tone to the interactions there? And that's one, which is, yeah, what's the why behind your what? Can I try to understand that?
The why behind your what? That's very good. And I would imagine that calls for a great deal of sympathy as well as empathy, and maybe even a bit for some to put themselves in that person's shoes, right? And like you said, I like how you use the phrase, you know, the lens, right? Looking through the lens of what, maybe what they see, you know, because obviously, you know, each of us have our individual experiences, and it's so easy for someone to say, well, if I was him, I would do this, or if I was her, I would do this. And I don't think that's fair. You know, I really don't. I don't think that's fair, because, no, if you were that person, you would do exactly what they're doing, because you haven't walked their journey, right? You haven't walked in their shoes. So am I hitting the nail on the head there with saying that the empathy, sympathy, and kind of putting yourself in that person's shoes can be very beneficial as well.
Absolutely. And I think, like, as you're saying, that question, if I take time to say, from your perspective, help me understand just where you're at and what you're getting mm-hmm. from this and what it's used. Often, like you said, what comes from that is empathy and sympathy, because often the conversation right. comes back to, we all have similar kind of, not identical perhaps, but I can hear you differently. I can hear you have anxiety or you have trauma. Or mm-hmm. or this helps you stay in your skin a little better in those moments where it's tough to do that. In that context, I can get a little bit more sympathy and empathy because I might have something that I can tap into myself seeing similar challenges. Mm-hmm. Even though I may go about it differently, I can hear and see you differently than perhaps what my judgmental mind will allow me to see.
That's good. That's very good. Now, I do know there are a lot of people, I myself used to be this way as well, where I used to have issues or challenges having challenging conversations, right? No matter who it was, if it was a peer at work, a supervisor at work, a parent, a brother, a sister, a friend, I used to really struggle with that communication. What do you recommend or suggest for a first step in regards to opening up that line of communication between yourself or someone and a loved one that may have issues with substance abuse or alcoholism or any type of addiction for that matter? And as I'm asking this question, I'm thinking through it. So maybe this is early on, right? This may be different for someone, and correct me if I'm wrong, this may be different for people dealing with this for the first time compared to working and dealing with someone maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years in.
I think that's an important point, right? You know, and that's something we throw out as conversations. It's never that you're starting on a blank slate. You know, there's history there, which is important mm-hmm. to at least to just acknowledge that. For some people, they're like, I've tried to have these conversations many, many times, and they just have never landed the way I'm hoping. So now I carry right. that history, and that's the first thing that kind of jumps out at me when I'm going back in to have that conversation. So that awareness is a useful thing to think about. And certainly, like you said, people who have been at it longer probably have a longer history. In some broad strokes, the first thing I would put out, which we're doing here, which is really probably not that common. You're listening to me. Like, I'm talking to you, and I know you're listening. You're giving me space to talk. And as a human being, if we think about how many interactions we have, how novel sometimes that experience is to be with someone who's just listening. So sometimes we think it's square one, just checking in. Can you listen? What's the challenges with that? You don't have to say anything. You don't have to have the perfect words. You don't have to have that magic phrase. But maybe tonight it's listen. And for an extra 5 minutes, giving that person just a little bit more mic time than perhaps mm-hmm. in the past. That sends a different signal. That starts to change the tone of how those interactions go for both people. And it's that could be the first entry back into saying, I hope we both have a different experience when we're sitting here together. And I'm going to try to create that or set the table for that by just listening to you more than perhaps I've done in the past, because I know it's been challenging. Mm-hmm. So you get to experience me differently. So for our next conversation, I might be able to then start to talk. And then that's kind of where we think about communication practice. It is a practice. And, you know, perhaps I can ask you how your day went. It doesn't have to be about the thing that I really want to talk to you about, the thing mm-hmm. that we've been trying to get to for weeks that has just kind of gone off the rails. But today, I'm going to do something different. I want to see you. I want to see the bigger you. So can I try to have a conversation about a less hot topic? it's not ignoring the other things that are out there, but it's, again, this idea of I want to help start to change the tone of our interactions, so our conversations start to get more traction. And when we talk about other things, we start to have a different history together. So listening, asking questions, or maybe trying to see the bigger person's perspective could be another entry point into conversations that have been difficult.
I like that. I like that. Very wise approach. Very wise. Thank you. Now, tell me about invitation to change approach, which you use in your practice. Can you specifically break that down for me and maybe give me an example, if you would, please, on regards to how you would apply that when dealing with in your clinical practice when dealing with a family or a person with substance addictive abuse issues.
Right. Well, in the title, we've went back and forth why the invitation, and my colleagues, Dr. Foote and Wilkins, really kind of wanted to set the tone from the upright that really we can't make someone change. We can't control others when we go down that road. And there's reasons even for our own feelings we would like to see people make change. But we can create a context for it where we can invite people to consider change, consider and checking in with the cells, being more aware, consider requests, consider their life in the context of our relationship. So the invitation to change is that it's how we can send invitations to yourself, like you said, self, which is important, but also self as a helper and for the person I'm trying to help to consider different options and pathways. And it really started to grow out of some of the work that was done decades ago that fortunately just sits on bookshelves often. I blame the psychology field for that. People do their work, they put it in a bookshelf, but where it doesn't go is it doesn't get in the hands of people that could really use it. And
right.
A lot of reasons for that. But this came from our work with families frontline who were saying, we get a lot of messages about how to be helpful. We've been told a lot of things about the way we should be with our loved ones. We've been stigmatized. We've been, made to feel like we're doing things wrong. We're wrong because we're too soft. We're wrong because we're too hard. The advice that was given to me, it really is not consistent with my values, the way I actually want to be there for my loved one. But the messaging was, I don't have a choice. So the invitation to change is really trying to call a lot of the ideas and concepts that give people choice and freedom to stay connected to their values,
okay,
to be able to connect with themselves, be aware of themselves as helpers, and at the same time offer a set of lenses that could be useful for how they think and look at their loved one and their loved one's process of change. And then some nuts and bolts about communication strategies, which you highlighted, and intentional responding. That's the way I'll talk about it, which is, mm-hmm, I'm going to interact with my loved one. Can I be thoughtful about how I respond to the way they're talking, the way their actions are? And if I can use that intentionality, it allows me to stay connected to the way I want to be in this moment, and bring in some ideas and skills for supporting the behaviors I want to help this person with and strengthen, and be intentional about how I want to respond to behaviors that I perhaps don't want to support. And all of that is kind of housed under this idea of the invitation to change approach, and offer families just a set of lenses for thinking about each of those different components.
Wow, that's great. This is such a two-way book. You know, as I mentioned earlier, not only for family members to learn how to help their loved ones, but it's almost a self-help as well, too. You have a lot of great, it's a true workbook, right? All these different exercises in here. And as you were speaking, it kind of came to me that, you wrote this book, for family members to be able to help loved ones that have a lot of challenges in their life. But some of these things that you mentioned, Dr. Carpenter, can maybe be used in other areas of life for oneself as well, you know, which is amazing. You know, it's very unique in that manner. That's good. I'm excited about this. This is really cool. Now, as I was looking through your book, and I saw on page 177, I believe it was, yeah, how to set limits. And this is a big one. Identify your boundaries and behavior that crosses them. Take some time to think about specific behaviors and interactions with your loved one that are not acceptable to you. When a boundary gets crossed, it's easy to become provoked and to label the whole person as irresponsible, entitled, spoiled, etc., rather than concentrating on the specific behavior that is unacceptable. That really hit home for me. You know, I've gone through a lot of growth myself over the last couple of years here, but I've learned to love myself better in that regards, to not allow people to cross those boundaries, to set my boundaries, to say, okay, no, you're not going to do this. I'm not going to take any crap off you. And it's not about that person, it's about me, because I learned to love myself better. So if you can take a few minutes to speak on that, how important, if you could just let our audience know how important it is when you are helping someone work through their journey, you know, in regards to substance abuse, addiction abuse, how important is it for you yourself to set those boundaries in order to effectively help them in return?
Yeah, I mean, I love the way you framed that. The real thing that kind of hit and resonated with me is we can talk about boundaries and limits, and sometimes we can frame it in terms of the behavior of the other person. And that's part of it. Where you started was first centering around oneself. What do I value in myself? What's my presence? What are the things that are central to me, the way I want to be treated, right? And even that can be what my values are around personal interactions and relationships and behavior. If I can start there, then boundaries and limits first start with allowing us to connect with our value system as a helper, as a person.
Yes.
So it starts with us being able to understand ourselves, which is really, really important. Because then that idea of limit setting doesn't become about controlling the other person. It really becomes this idea of how can I communicate to others my values, the way I would like to be present and interacting with you, and being able to give you feedback that the way this is going is not in alignment with my values.
Oh, I like that. Yes, sir.
Which is the way you framed it. And that's beautiful, because actually it's hard to get defensive when you hear someone saying, this is my values, and this right now, what's happening here, is just not aligning with that. That's a much different message than you've got a problem, and making it about the others. And I think that's where we start with it. But once you identify that, then it becomes, how do you best communicate that? How do you help someone hear you about what those boundaries are, what those values are, and offer the person a compass so that they know where their behavior's going against your values, where it's not. And helping, in a sense, that communication does give people blueprints about where and how they can align with your values and make this relationship is going. So communication, we're back to that. And you'll see skills just in the book. We call them SURF skills or I statements. A lot of this stuff, you know, I think people have come into contact with in different ways. But let me use my voice to help my loved one know this is what I value. I may value our interactions as well. Yet the way I'm experiencing you now, the behavior you're doing, that's crossed over a line for me and my values. So I'm going to respond in an intentional way to that to help you hear that and give you the opportunity to recalibrate
Oh, I like that. Yes, I like that. And that can be challenging. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about my interactions with a loved one who has a addiction issue. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I've learned to do that right with him, or just in general. And I've applied the same thing when dealing with him, setting those boundaries. And that can be a challenge. You know, it really can, because especially with this individual who is very headstrong and doesn't like to be wrong. And this individual always, well, I shouldn't say always, because his mindset has changed a bit. But for the longest, he had the mindset of, I'm okay, nothing is wrong with me. You know, I'm okay. And it wasn't until earlier this year when he lost a job, had a really good job, and he lost his job due to his alcohol issue. And that really hurt him a lot. And I was one of the first people, maybe the first person he called, and he, you know, just laid his heart on the line to me, like, oh my goodness, man, this happened, and you know, and I helped him through that. So I, you know, that told me that there was a change here, because prior to that, and he's lost a couple jobs due to his alcoholism, but this was the first time that he really took responsibility and accountability for it, you know, which was great to see. You know, but because of his behavior and because he is still struggling and going through it, you know, I said there still are times, you know, and I have my boundaries there and I made them very clear. But, you know, for whatever reason, it can get to a point where he doesn't respect that, you know, and it causes this issue. And, you know, at that point, when it gets there, I just end the call. You know, respectfully, I don't argue with him. I don't go back and forth with him. That's not who I am. That's not my energy. That's not the type of energy I want to project. I just say, hey buddy, you know, I'll talk to you later. You know, I'm gonna end the call now. So that's what works best for me. But what do you recommend for people that may have that issue, day in and day out, or week in and week out, where they set those boundaries but they're not being respected by their loved one? What is the best way to deal with those type of individuals?
Well, you know, the power in what you just said and highlighted, I want to put a light on that for a second, because some of the things that you just highlighted is setting boundaries doesn't have to be about punishing. It doesn't have to be about inflicting pain on another individual. It doesn't have to be coming from a hurtful space. The beautiful way you laid that out, which there was nothing in that tone of voice that had that motivation, although it was clear to say, I have to end this right now. This just, it's not being useful, or we're at a point here where for myself, I'm just going to step out. And that in a sense just sends communication to another one in a way that they're probably more likely to hear that than if it's coming from more of an aggressive spot. And what's proof in that is you could end that. But who did that person call when they started really considering, this is a time I have to start thinking about making change?
Great point, doctor. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Got it. Huh.
And to your credit in that is that, that's kind of the importance of human connection, human relationships, and in a sense, keeping that porch light on. It doesn't mean I have to be with you every moment. It doesn't mean I have to stay in this conversation or stay in this current interaction. And let me explain to you either beforehand, this is how I'm going to respond to those situations, or like you did, right, in the tone, which is, in this isn't working right now, I'm going to step out. I'm stepping back for a moment. But your relationship was still there. And some people change fast, some don't. But what the power was is when they were hurting and they were starting to think about, I need to make change.
Mm-hmm.
They reached out to you.
Yes, sir. Yes, they did. Yes, they did. Wow.
So that's, that would be the, you know, like you're saying, that's one way for setting limits. That's one way for stepping away is okay. It doesn't mean And even that question we talked about in the beginning, which is, can I understand your why, doesn't mean I have to agree with it. Doesn't mean I have to even see it that way from my perspective. And at the same time, I can try to understand, at least from your perspective, the way you're seeing it. And that is also a powerful move, because if people feel heard, they actually may be more likely to consider changing than if they feel pushed in a direction. It's just human nature to dig your heels in sometimes when you feel like someone's pushing hard on you, you know? So it creates a little flexibility there. Because as you noted, often change comes from people's lived experience. When something they value gets hit on. And it's, is there traction there for when that happens?
Right. Well said. Now, I want to talk to you about what's been going on over the last couple of years here when we've been dealing with this pandemic, right? And we've been going through some very interesting times in our country, or in the world for that matter. What I tell people, or what I say personally, it's been a lot of chaos and confusion, right? A lot of disinformation. People don't know who to trust. People don't know what to do. We're experiencing something that we've never experienced in our lifetimes. And I would think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of these things that we've been dealing with have really hit hard for a lot of people in regards to them, starting drugs, drinking more and more. So my question for you is, have you seen, you know, through your research and working with your patients clinically, has there been an increase in substance abuse during the pandemic? Have you seen a rise in that over the last couple of years, sir?
I think more currently in the recent kind of surveys, household surveys, there's definitely been an increase in substance use on numerous dimensions, certainly in younger ages too, but also with adults. So drinking rates have increased, other substance use, certainly, the opioid use has continued. Dose rates have gone up, which I know you spoke about on your show several weeks ago as well. So I think, to your point, I can't think at a time, just like you said, where everything was so upended and there were so many challenges to living, both in families, the pressures around interacting, social support systems being totally tore down, traditional roles that gave meaning and purpose to one's day all of a sudden disappeared. And I think, people leaned on substance use more, and there's been a spike over time. Last year and a half or 2 years, for sure.
Is substance abuse or addictive behavior genetic? And I heard one scientist state that it could also be epigenetic as well. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. Genetic, I think there's a genetic component to it. Research would say, look, if we want to think of ourselves on a biological level, we know it tracks in families. That doesn't mean just because it tracks in families, that means it's got to be genetics. But I think there's evidence to say that we share biology with relatives. So certain ways our biology has unfolded over time can put certain people at more risk than others. I know in some of the research, they still kind of try to figure out why, when my friend Sam has a beer, he can take it or leave it. But when I have a beer, it's like nirvana. I just experience it so much different. And, you hear people talk, why I, for those that struggle with it, why does it affect me so much more impactfully than the way I see it impact my friends? And I think that's, if you push down in there, there's probably some genetic contribution to what we each find reinforcing. You know, what lights our brain up? And we're all different in that way. And genetics probably lay down a little bit of a foundation for how the world affects us or impacts us.
I see.
It doesn't start at all, but...
Right, but it's a start. It's helpful, definitely. I was wondering if it was genetic, if like genetic therapy could be a help, or I don't want to say a cure, but you know, I guess a help, an assistance to that. Do you think that would be possible?
I think if they can map it out over time, who knows where that could lead. I'm always struck by some of the things out there where they've identified the exact genetic sequence. They've identified all the pathways from the genes all the way down to like the organ. Like we could think of certain cancers or certain things. And even with all that knowledge, finding, like you're pointing out, an intervention, a way of changing that, is a monumental lift. So it will be really fascinating as we understand on that level the human condition. I think you're right. Perhaps they'll find very effective ways of helping people along those lines. I guess the jury's still out. You know, it's heavy lifting.
All right. Now, what about what some may consider unconventional ways to help people with substance and addiction issues? Right. I spoke with someone probably about within the last couple months here, and they were a big advocate on meditation and having someone or recommending someone get involved in some type of spirituality, whether it be church or something along those lines. What are your thoughts on that?
I think there's room for a lot of different pathways to change. The common aspects to there, because sometimes we use different words, but then when you sit down with someone and you're like, well, yeah, how are you using your word? And then you find out, like, well, I use a different word, but man, we're on the same page when it comes to that. Mindfulness, right? Self-awareness, the be able to sit in your own personal space and be able to observe what shows up for you and be able to make room for your own internal process, hugely, hugely helpful, not only in the role of helper, but even in our own personal journeys. So, and people are constantly trying to help, you know, well, if I want to make change, if I can become more aware with my own reactivity and my own internal currents, I get a little flexibility to make more intentional decisions. I don't become a hostage to some of the automatic stuff that used to happen to me because meditation helped me kind of just stay on top of that a little bit better than maybe years ago. So I agree with you, Jess. I think meditation can be a huge strategy and practice. Spirituality, this is the way I kind of think about it. And people use all different terms, but to your point is, what gives you purpose? What brings meaning to your life?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Sometimes behaviorists or some of the addiction community in the research world, they'll talk about competing reinforcers, and it can lose its meaning. But I think at its core, it's when I think about my pursuits in life, if I can connect with the thing that gives me purpose and value. Mm-hmm. Now, I may have that and I just got to dust it off. Or maybe I've been just kind of journeying in life and I never was given the opportunity to really think about that, which is what gives my life meaning. But with that, other things become less or more important. And I think that's a powerful message, even sometimes that's lost in the dialogue around addiction. Sometimes the narrative can be so much about the molecule, which is, it's this drug, the molecule, it's going to hijack you, it's going to take. But let's also step back to the bigger vision of all of substance use is done in the bigger context of our lives. And part of that context is what's meaningful. And sometimes people just haven't connected with that. And to your point, that's powerful stuff, man. You know, really to be able to start to chart that out.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And as you were speaking, you know, in regards to everything you said, you know, it makes me think about chapter two in your book when you talk about one size doesn't fit all, mm-hmm. right? And that's powerful within itself. You know, like you said, it could be meditation for some people, it could be spirituality, and other courses of action that you take when you help your patients. So can you kind of go into that a bit when we talk about one size doesn't fit all, right? I think this is very important because when you talk about finding purpose, I think at the end of the day, right, most people, we're looking for some sense of peace. I think that's what it comes down to, because I think when you find your purpose, you find peace. Part of my purpose is, you know, finding my purpose was starting this podcast a couple years ago. And to a sense, I found this great sense of peace, this great sense mm-hmm. of freedom, this great sense of liberation, because I stepped into doing something that I was created to do, which was to help people, to give back, to provide some sort of knowledge that can help humanity. You know, that's my way of being a servant to humanity, right? And for me, it was peace. And we're all different. But again, circling back to that one size fits all, how important is that? And how is that used in what you do day in and day out in your career?
Yeah, I think, you know, another kind of set of lenses that can really open doors on different levels. And I think if we're working with families, because sometimes the messaging has been change has to look like this. And if your loved one isn't doing it that way, right, then it ain't real. Mm-hmm. And families can feel pressure around that. They can then feel like, I can't try to understand my loved one, or it doesn't make sense to listen to my loved one because they're talking differently than the way I'm told they should be talking. So if we can create room to say, and the evidence would back this up in a way, but with families, you know, people change in all kinds of ways. People find a pathway. So what's really helpful and what can be useful is, can you help just collaborate for a person and help them articulate from their perspective what's the best way to change? Because sometimes we can miss that. People can start to say, I'm willing to give this a shot because I want things to be different, but it sounds different than some of the messaging, so it's questioned or it's not supported. So one is helping loved ones connect for their change process that makes sense to them and creating room to support that. And that gives families some hope that my loved one might be going about this a little differently, but that doesn't mean we're going down a dead end necessarily.
Right.
Gives families, you know, flexibility for their values. Well, this is the way we value. This is the way we embrace a spiritual perspective. We embrace this way of relating, and that's okay. You don't have to leave that at the door. Your family's values, the way you want to be present with your loved one, there's room for that because there's not just one size. For the loved one, or when I'm sitting with someone who's entertaining change, and back to your points of, you know, meditation or spirituality, I'm listening for that person finding purpose. That's the way I see our work. I want to be with you and walk with you to help you find your purpose, help you articulate that, envision that. Because when you do connect with it, to your point, that feels different. That often feels like a way you've never felt before.
Ooh, strong, powerful, man, powerful. Yes.
So let's walk through that door. Because I am not prescribing a door for you, but I am saying I agree with you. Finding purpose is like going to be an important thing here. You know, there's got to be something meaningful on the end of that change process.
And at times there's a fear factor associated with that as well, right? Because I would think that both parties are going through this unchanted, unexplored area, right? Where they're working through something, they're on this journey together, they're working through something, and you know, they don't know how it's going to turn out. Obviously, you know, you're phenomenal at what you do, and you wrote this phenomenal book, the Beyond Addiction Work for Family and Friends. But it has to be I would think that it has to be a fearful thing. And like I always tell people, I really believe that the Most High, God, Father, Source, whatever we want to call it, places the very best things in life on the other side of fear. There's no going around it. There's no avoiding it. If you want that peace, right, that I mentioned earlier, you know, you have to go through it. And once you go through it, and it's nothing better than going through something with someone that you love or that loves you, right? You go on that journey together and you go through it. There's something very special, as you know, because you've been helping people for a long time. You know that there's something very, very special on the other side of that. You know, we talk about that feeling, that peace, that love there. So that's awesome, Dr. Carpenter. That is so awesome. I thank you so much for being here with us today on the Hidden Gateway podcast. I want to ask you a question. Now, I ask each and every guest this when they come on the Hidden Gateway podcast. I want to ask you to leave our listeners with what I like to call a token of love, right? Something that they can take with them on their journey as they move forward. It can be a minute. It can be 3 minutes. It can be 5 minutes. Whatever comes to heart, what would you like for our listeners to know today?
Wow, yeah, that's a deep question. Just, but so important. Thanks for throwing it out there. Get my mind around that. You know, I think comes back to humanness. There's something so powerful to being allowed to embrace our humanness. Without having, like, in its entirety, that, as you've highlighted, Brent, means I'm going to experience fear when moving towards the things that I potentially really value. I know there'll be challenges when I am a little further than the person I was hoping to be in that moment. When we don't have that crystal ball and we're trying to navigate life as it's unfolding in real time. So much of the narrative, so much of the things out there says that's not allowable. There's a fault for that. Or that's what separates people who seem to have it together from those that don't. There must be a missing or secret sauce there. And I think the secret sauce is, to your point, is we're all human. And there's a commonality there. And if we can step back and embrace our humanness and the challenges that come with that, see that in ourselves, and see that with others, that just positions us, I think, in a way to be more compassionate with ourselves, be a mentor to ourselves as we mentor so many other people, and can sit with other people who are hurting, but somehow sit with ourselves differently in those times where we're doing it. And it takes practice, but my token is, even having gone to psychology school, and I always say this with people, is I've never educated myself out of the human experience. And there's something humbling about that. And that's and it's also powerful because I know I'm connected with everybody else I'm sitting with. We're human. And that's my wish for everybody, to be able to sit with people and sit in a space that allows them to be fully themselves and fully human.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. That is powerful. Sit in a space with someone else and allow themselves to be fully human, fully themselves. I like that a lot. That is true human spirit right there. No matter where we're from, no matter what we look like, we all are human. We all are in this thing called life together, right? And that's what it is. And that is so powerful, Dr. Carpenter. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Hidden Gateway podcast. Now, your book here, I'm going to say it once again, the Beyond Addiction Workbook for Family and Friends, Evidence-Based Skills to Help a Loved One Make a Positive Change. Phenomenal book. Workbook, as I said, lots of exercises in here for not only your loved ones, but for self as well. We have 9 chapters broken down into 3 parts in here. Part 1, helping with understanding. Chapter 1, behaviors make sense. Chapter 2, one size fits all. Then we have ambivalence is normal. Part 2, helping with awareness. We have self-awareness, let you be you. Realness is difficult. way to relate to pain, self-compassion, and you have the final part, part three, chapter seven, good communication turns red lights green. I like that. Like that. I'm really big on communication, so that one really resonates. Chapter eight, inviting your loved one to get help, a special case of communication. And chapter nine, your behavior shapes theirs. Again, great book. As I told you earlier, I've read a great portion of this book, and I'm going to use this because, as I've mentioned a few times here, I have a loved one who struggles with addiction issues, alcoholism, and I'm going to use this, and I'm going to stay in contact with you to let you know how things go. Thank you so much for what you do. Can you let our listeners know where they can find your book, and also let them know any websites or social media information that you'd like to share?
Sure thing, Justin. Thank you for giving me the opportunity for that. Mm-hmm. The book is on Amazon. It can be ordered through there or New Harbinger's websites. They're the ones that supported the process of getting it out there in print. So anyone who's interested can look on those two distribution websites. Our website or organization is cmcffc.org. That's the not-for-profit, and our mission there is to try to bring all these resources and make them really available. So anyone who's looking for a compass or some guidance or a community for support can check us out on that website, and we have tons of resources and ideas for families who are looking to create some supportive scaffolding for themselves and their loved one. So invite all your listeners to check our organization out, and we're trying to continuously run ways to help families think about this and bring this into their life in a way that resonates with them.
Awesome. Dr. Carpenter, again, thank you so much. You're doing an awesome thing with what you do. Thank you for all you do, and keep fighting a good fight, my friend. You're doing it right, and I appreciate you. And to our listeners of the Hidden Gateway podcast, we really hope you enjoyed this episode today. As always, remember to stay connected with us at thehiddengateway.com. If you want to chat with us, like a lot of you do, shoot us an email at support@thehiddengateway.com. And as always, thank you for pushing your mindset towards a better reality. Our YouTube is back up. We're finally out of YouTube jail, good people. So if you're not subscribed to our channel, go ahead and subscribe to our channel, The Hidden Gateway, on YouTube. Now, this will conclude this week's episode. Until next time, stay positive, stay questioning, be love, and be free. The Hidden Gateway, out.